Well, many of you know, and if you don't know, then you'll know now, that several times for a number of years we have made a little pilgrimage out to San Diego for some R&R, and we do that because we've got some special friends out there. We've got a lot of special friends in the church, but we got really, really special friends that we've had for many, many years. And they are elders and wives serving in the San Diego congregation, Paul and Jackie Smith. We've got at least one child that is about the same age. They have a daughter, and we have one son that is the same age as their daughter. And for the last 25 years or so at least, we've kept a lot of feast sites together, been at a lot of the same feast sites. We've especially enjoyed our time together in the state of Hawaii, and we've had wonderful times there for many years at the feast, and then also in California, San Diego, down at San Diego State University, and up in Oceanside, and also in what's the name of the other town up there? Escondido, yeah. So Escondido. So we've had all of those times together, and Paul Smith and Robin Weber have been gracious enough to let me speak in that church area a number of times. And when Paul and Jackie said, hey, do you have room at the Thanksgiving table? I didn't think it would be too hard to twist Paul's arm and ask him to reciprocate this time. So we're very happy. This is not the first time you've spoken in the city of Tucson, right? You've probably spoken at the feast, right? No. Who didn't put you on the speaking schedule for the feast? That would be me. Maybe it was the home office or headquarters. That was, I don't do the schedule. You know, they don't allow me to do that. But I'll remember the first time. I've got a little time because we didn't have a sermon at, and I'm streamlining things because Joe let me lead songs. I remember the first time I met the Smiths was in 1989, and that was the year of Paul's ordination into the ministry. He had been a deacon for many years. But I remember this beautiful young couple walking up the middle aisle. I knew exactly who they were. This was the second feast we ever kept as a family in Tucson under the old organization. Had a lot of people there. But I remember Paul and Jackie, beautiful, lovely couple, coming up and congratulating Paul on his recent ordination, which was in the Feast of Trumpets, 1989. And we weren't immediate friends at that particular time. We didn't, you know, get to know each other immediately then, but eventually we did. And we're very thankful for their friendship. We're very thankful for the love that they've showed to the congregations in Southern California, because during the times of some of the crises in 1995, it was the Smiths who really held that group together. They didn't have a pastor for a while, and I think maybe for almost even, maybe even up to a year, there was not a church pastor assigned there, but Smiths have been anchors in that congregation going way back to the 70s. So that gives you a little bit of a brief introduction, and Paul's got a lot of time here, so he's free to be able to add any of the details that I haven't, should he wish to. But without any further ado, I'd like to welcome the Smiths officially to our church congregation. This will be their sister congregation, as San Diego's is ours now. But for the sermon today, Mr. Paul Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Buchanan. I think that rehearsal of our history was the best side of it. You didn't mention the times during those difficult trial years when our pictures were up at the post office, at the home office, and our pictures are still up there now. But it's because we've been in the ministry more than 25 years. the Buchanans have been very good friends of ours, as he mentioned. We look out and see some familiar faces as well. We did attend the feast in Tucson from beginning 1973 for 17 years in a row. Some of you can probably beat that, but it's not a bad record to have. And we always enjoyed coming over to Tucson and having the Feast of Tabernacles over here. I know he's got me boxed in quite a bit. I usually like to wander, and I know he does too, so I don't know if he gets up and walks on the chairs as he moves around or not, but we weren't able to do that. I just might mention that the Feast of Tabernacles in Oceanside this year, or in previous years, we've had fairly small stages. This year we had a big stage. I lobbied very hard to get a bigger stage. And the day that I was speaking, the lapel mics went out, so I was stuck with my little microphone right in front of me. So I did go out and wave to each side of the building and the crowd and let them know that that Robin had come through and the setup people had given us plenty of stage. I just wasn't going to be able to make use of it like I normally would. So, any rate, appreciate being over here and having the opportunity to speak today. Steve usually goes for about 15 minutes before he says you can start the clock, but I'm going to go ahead and start mine now because he doesn't like to run overtime, and neither do I. We won't be running overtime today, but I've got a sermonette, a split sermon, and a sermon to give you. The good news is that it all blends together into one message, and shouldn't be that bad. Anyone ever panned for gold? Probably you have. A few have. And how about mining though? Have you ever been down in a mine to pan for, not pan for gold, but where you have to dig for it? And you know, Mr. Leonard Scriber, most of us are familiar with him. He was in our congregation for a number of years, and he always had a period of time every year that he took off and went panning for gold. And I don't believe he ever quite struck it rich, but he had enough that he could jingle a little in his pocket and show it off and have a story to tell. But it just should remind us that while gold sometimes is easily found on the surface, most of the time you have to work hard to get something that's valuable and worthwhile. And mining is certainly no exception. It is a hard form of work. The rewards are often greater than what's found on the surface, though. We grew up, Jackie and I did, in little towns in southern Illinois where the two big employers in the towns around there were coal mining and building Norge washing machines and dryers. So when I would see young men as we go out and got graduated from high school and you get closer to the time, you know, and of course, this was the 1960s, mid 60s, so the Vietnam War was going, and we were all hoping and praying that the last class that graduated would be the last ones that had to go, not the rest of us. But of course, that continued on for several years afterwards, and hooked me in it as well. But I would see these guys come back from the military having an opportunity to do what I thought was to get away from coming back into the same old rut of coal mining or, you know, building washing machines. Neither one of them turned me on too much, the ideas of it. And so Jackie and I decided that we would make an effort to try and stay in San Diego. Not always easy to do. To live in paradise costs a lot of money. And we were fortunate. God bless us both with good jobs. And so we were able to do that. And we've been in San Diego since the fall of 1971, other than a couple of years that we went back to Chicago to be involved with the business of my dad's, and escaped that finally after 2.5 years. Two winters that broke all records for most snow and most cold, and I hadn't been in a winter for 10 years. It was a sign that it wasn't going to be good for us. But at any rate, we came back to California in August of 1980. Actually, July of 1980, and have been there ever since. Happy to please there. Today, what I'd like to do is to mine with you and share a revealing backstory on one of the settings, the most familiar settings in the Bible, and one of the most important stories. And I want to talk with you about the importance of the empty tomb of Jesus. I don't know how much thought you might have given over the years to the tomb and what importance it played, but I'll give you a little background today, some research that I did. I find that the messages that I enjoyed the most preparing and giving are the ones that have sparked an interest in me when I read something and said, I need to think about that. How would that happen? How would that come about? And so this message today is a result of that. And I've titled it The Empty Tomb of Jesus. Unlike the Romans or the Greeks and other Gentiles who cremated their dead, the children of Israel typically interred their dead either in the ground or in tombs and in caves. The Holman Bible Dictionary, I'll cite here from their topic of the Hebrew burial, says partly because of the warm climate of Palestine and partly because the corpse was considered ritually impure, the Hebrews buried their dead as soon as possible and usually within 24 hours of death. To allow a body to decay or be desecrated above the ground was highly dishonorable. And any corpse found by the wayside was required to be buried. And there's scriptural references. If you want those later on, I'll be happy to share them with you. But though the Bible, I continue, nowhere systematically describes Hebrew mortuary practice, several features can be gleaned from the individual passages. Joseph closed his father's eyelids soon after his death. You can read in Genesis 46:4. Jesus' body was, of course, prepared for burial by anointing with aromatic oils and spices and wrapping in a linen cloth. We'll be reading more about that in Mark 16 and Luke 24. The arms and legs of Lazarus' body were bound with cloth and the face covered by a napkin. The body of Tabitha was washed in preparation for burial. So the dead were buried in caves, in rock-cut tombs or in the ground, and it was desirable to be buried in the family tomb. So Sarah, Abraham, Isaac, Rebecca, Leah, and Jacob were all buried in the cave at Machpelah, east of Hebron. Burial sites were marked by trees, as noted in Genesis 35, verse 8, pillars and piles of stones. The burials of the wealthy or politically powerful. I want you to keep this in mind. The burial of the wealthy or politically powerful were sometimes accompanied by lavish accessories, including robes, jewelry, furniture, weapons, pottery, and just mausoleums, statues, those sorts of things that were typical for the more wealthy. In contrast, I continue, to its wide usage among the Greeks and Romans, cremation is not described as a normal practice in the Bible. Perhaps bodies were cremated only in exceptional cases such as decay or following mutilation or the threat of of a plague. I'm having a hard time seeing my notes up here. But it's my eye that's bothering me, not the light. Even in these instances, cremation was partial so that the bones remained. Embalming is mentioned only in the burial accounts of Jacob and Joseph in Genesis 50. And they're only because of the Egyptian setting and plans to move the bodies later. And apparently embalming was an Egyptian practice, and I think we're familiar with that. When preparations for burial were completed, the body was usually placed on a bier and carried to the burial site in a procession with friends and relatives and servants. The procession carried out the mourning ritual, which could include baldness and cutting of beard, rending of garments, wearing of sackcloth, loud and agonized weeping, and putting of dust on the head and sitting in ashes. End quotes from the Hebrew topic on Hebrew burial in Holman's Dictionary. So these tombs were also known as sepulchres. Sepulchre is a tomb or a grave when it's introduced first in Genesis 23, verse 6. It translates a Hebrew word which refers to a niche that's hewn out of rock. And to me, niche is a niche in something is a relatively small chip, if you will, or nip out of something. That's not what we're talking about here. This is full size for at least a body. If not, if it's a family tomb, it would be made much, much bigger and with a typically a stand in front for the current or most recent deceased. And then as time went on and others died and got down to the bones of that person, they'd be moved back into another part of the sepulcher. But nevertheless, it's a word which means hewn out of rock, and bodies were placed there. In ancient times, sepulchers usually were carved out of the walls in existing caves. It's nice to have a good start if you got an existing cave. It saves an awful lot of work. My dad, I recall, I haven't thought of this in years, but thinking about digging in our basement as we were growing up, he was trying to keep us busy always and not have to pay us for whatever he was doing. Helping him, he was in the plumbing and heating business, and I was a plumber's helper and worked summers and after school and so forth. But we decided that we played so much pool, shooting pool, because the only thing to do in a town of 2,500 people was two pool halls and two drug stores. So you had to learn to shoot pool as you're a boy growing up. So we wanted to have a pool table. And he said, fine, I'll buy you a pool table. I'll buy you the best pool table you want. Just you guys, my brother and I, he said, you guys dig it out here under the house, and we'll pour concrete and we'll do all that. Mm-hmm. We hewed out about maybe 5 feet. And we decided, there are better ways to learn to play pool than digging in the underneath the basement of your house, you know. Goodness. He took us off subject here. Pardon me anyway. I don't have anything funny in my notes for this message anyway. We had a cold boiler. And it was typical of that period of the age, the middle of the last century, coal-fired, water-circulating boiler that heated the house. And in the winter, of course, there were two major jobs of keeping a boiler going and keeping your house warm in the winter. One was putting coal in the hopper so that there was coal to feed into the furnace to burn, and the other was taking the clinkers out, the ashes that were left. It would be big green iron donuts, practically. And this was a job that my brother and I got to do that. And until we both left home, and within a week, my dad converted it over to a natural gas boiler. No more coal, no more ashes, no more clinkers. I said, Dad, why couldn't you have done that a few years ago? Yeah, you guys are cheaper than the gas. Jesus spoke of whitewashed tombs and whitened sepulchers in Matthew 23. Let's go there and begin to get into our scriptures today in Matthew 23, verses 27 through 29. He says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous. They were outwardly pure. They were outwardly beautiful to look at. But on the inside, there were dead people's bones. And he compares their religious positions very similar to that. That you look good on the outside when you come walking through the door to services. You dress nice. You look like you've been just praying every minute of the whole week long. And how often are there errors or sins that we don't see? So he's describing these, and you're familiar here that when he talks about the scribes and the Pharisees and in other scriptures as well, he condemns the other group that was most familiar in that first century era time, or one of the most, and that was, of course, the Sadducees. We'll see even before we're done today that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, well, I hope to share a little something with you that you might not have considered before. It was one of the things that led me to put this message together with the questions that were raised. But anyway, so with this material as background, let's begin our story. Jesus predicts his own death and burial in Matthew 12, verse 38 through 40. Matthew 12, beginning in verse 38, he says, "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, 'Teacher, we want to see a sign from you.'" They want to see a sign that would prove in some way that he was the Son of God, as he claimed. "But he answered and said to them, 'An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, for no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah.'" And what was the sign of the prophet Jonah? Verse 40, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." This is the only sign that Jesus gave. And he mentioned it many times to his disciples and to others in the crowds that that visited and attended some of his messages, his preaching. And as for Jonah, there's no Hebrew idiom, as some will claim in the Greek, that allows you to get 3 days and three nights in between Friday and Sunday morning. No such idiom that allows for that and anything other than complete 24-hour periods of time, which, for just touching the surface of another iceberg, if you will, points us back to Jonah and makes me question, did Jonah actually die and become and resurrected when he came out of the great fish? I think so, but then we're not told specifically. But by comparison to Jesus, we know that Jesus did, and he said that was the comparison of what he would do. So not only were these events involving his death prophesied, as we just have been reading about, and there's also a fulfillment of prophecy. Isaiah 53, verse 9. Isaiah 53:9. I'm going to read from a few different versions here. The New King James, first of all. And it says, "And they made his grave with the wicked." They're speaking of where Jesus would be buried, how he would be buried, with grave with the wicked. Now, that's something to keep in mind when we think about, I'm jumping ahead just a little bit, but let you know where we're moving in this train of thought, is that if Jesus was buried in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, and he was a rich man, why was he having a tomb that would be buried in the vicinity of wicked men who had died and been buried there? So just keep that in the back of your mind. Isaiah 53:9 in the NIV said he was assigned a grave with the wicked. Isaiah 53:9 in the New American Standard Bible says his grave was assigned with wicked men. It was the intent of the Lord's adversaries that the means of his death, being crucified and hanged on a cross and left unburied, should be as disgraceful and humiliating as possible. With only the minimum amount of time for burial among the wicked, like condemned criminals who were crucified with him on Golgotha. Another little thing that you might consider and think about in your private study: Jesus was condemned and was crucified, counted among, it says, the transgressors in the King James Version. You're familiar with that. Trace that word back and see how that leads, and see if it doesn't bring you to the same conclusion that I had about that, that Jesus was condemned and crucified among other rebels. They were zealots, the opposition force, kind of a guerrilla force that were trying to get rid of the Romans in the Holy Land in that early first century. So just another thing to think about, and I think it's a fulfillment. He wasn't just with transgressors, but with rebels, and he was charged, as you'll recall, before the Romans with declaring himself a king. And they said that they should have no king but Caesar, and he was indeed a king, but was counted with the rebels. Anyway, back to this point, I'm probably taking too much time away from this message, but give you something to think about. So the latter part of verse 9 of Isaiah 53, I only read the first portion of it before. The second portion of it says, but with the rich at his death. In other words, his grave was assigned with the wicked and with the rich at his death. Hinting and prophesying about Joseph of Arimathea, a very wealthy man, to provide that burial place for him. Because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth, the NIV, and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth, and in NASB, yet he was a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. So we get to the point in our story now to enter Joseph of Arimathea. The time frame here, once again, if you recall, is about 30 AD. And Arimathea was a city of the Jews located about 25 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And here's what we know about this man, Joseph of Arimathea. Matthew 27 verse 57 says that he was a rich man. Okay, he's a rich man. Mark 15 verse 43 says that he's a prominent member of the Sanhedrin and a Sadducee, more than likely, because of the position, the family position, the wealthy position. The Sadducees had the priesthood, basically. If you look at them as political parties, and in the way that the first century historian Josephus explained it, the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Herodians were political parties. That's the way he couched it in his history, even though they were very much religious parties as well. And while the Pharisees' strength and power came in the base, or their base, if you will, was within the synagogues. The priests, or the Sadducees, power base was among the priesthood. They were the wealthier of the people and had been for years and years in different families and so forth. And actually, by the time it got to the first century, the priesthood in Jerusalem was no longer a Levitical priesthood, but had roots in another family, the name of which escapes me at the moment. But they basically bought their way into the priesthood from the Romans when the Romans came in and conquered them and allowed them to have a religion, but with limitations that the Romans put on them. But it was, he was a prominent member of the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin was like the Supreme Court of the time for both religious and secular matters, although there were some restrictions and limitations placed on them as well. They were nevertheless very prominent, had the seat of power in the priesthood, and so I surmise and I infer, think it likely, maybe it's not. It could be that Joseph of Arimathea was a Pharisee. He was either a Pharisee or a Sadducee, one of the two. He's a member of the Sanhedrin and followed Christ. So let me back up and pick up the thought where I was, that prominent member of Sanhedrin in Mark 15. He was a Sadducee and a righteous man who opposed the condemnation of Jesus and sought the kingdom of God. You remember in Luke 23, verses 50 to 51, Jesus was being charged in front of the council and condemned to death. Joseph of Arimathea is one who opposed that condemnation and sought to free Jesus, but of course he didn't carry the day with the antipathy that there was for Jesus by these people whose positions were in jeopardy should the Romans decide to change the way of dealing with the Jews in Jerusalem. So, and like Nicodemus, we see in John 3, verse 10, that Joseph of Arimathea is a teacher of Israel. A teacher of Israel as well. So let's pick up the story at Golgotha in John 19. If you want to join me in John 19, we'll be there for a little bit. So we have here just as a bit of a recap about Joseph of Arimathea, and then it'll apply to Nicodemus as well as we get to the background on him. They were secret disciples of Jesus, as we'll come to see. And they did not come out, to borrow a modern term, didn't come out of the closet about it. They were afraid of what the Pharisees and the Sadducees would do to them, but they heard the message, and they had conviction. They just hadn't acted on it yet. And I think we'll see that there's going to be a change in that. Let's back into the story here in John 19, verses 30 through 37. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. And therefore, because it was a preparation day, that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, and that they might be taken away. Now, the Jews that asked this, these were obviously not supporters of Jesus, but they were looking for their customs and their traditions that no one should be left hanging on a tree overnight, alive or dead. But in this particular case, they were trying to expedite the death of the other thieves that are on the stake there with Jesus. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the other who was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And when he who has testified, and his testimony is pure, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you may believe. For these things were done that the scriptures should be fulfilled, that not one of his bones should be broken. And again, in another scripture, it says, "They shall look on him whom they pierced." In John 19, verse 38, we see here that Joseph, well, as I mentioned earlier, was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly. In verse 38, I'm going to read in a moment. These were secret disciples. Joseph and Nicodemus were members of the Sanhedrin. Both of them were. Both respected Jesus as a man. They admired him as a teacher, and they believed in him as a Messiah. And yet, up to this point in time, had lacked the courage or the conviction to confess him openly before men. Dreading the hostility of their colleagues of the Sanhedrin, they kept their faith a secret. There have been many times through the history of the church when one just wonders, would you have been a disciple, a secret disciple, or come out and let people really know? There have been, of course, many thousands and thousands of Christians who have been killed through the years because of that. Now, at verse 38 through 40 of John 19, after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took the body of Jesus. Now, here's Joseph coming to the Roman procurator, Pilate, and begging, it says begging in some of the translations, but asking for his body so that he could bury it. And while typically the Romans could care less about Jewish ideas and whatever made them happy, they were just as happy to make Jews unhappy as they were to make Romans happy. So it's kind of unusual that the body was given not to a family member, but to another member, in this case of the Sanhedrin. And Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came. This is verse 39, bringing a mixture of myrrh, aloes, of about 100 pounds. And then they took the body of Jesus and bound it in strips of linen with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury. Now, both of these men stepped out of their secrecy now. Pilate, having gone and asked for Jesus' body, he came back and took him down from the cross, likely in the presence of at least a few of the Sanhedrin members who had been there to witness the death of this heretic in their minds. They took him and buried him. They put at risk everything they possessed, their wealth, their position, even their own lives. They placed everything at risk with both the Jews and the Romans by coming out as disciples and followers of Jesus. Isn't it interesting? Who do we read about being at the crucifixion? A few of the disciples were there earlier, and John and Mary and so forth. The numbers dwindled, especially after his death. And who came and got the body? A Pharisee and a Sadducee, who are no longer keeping their faith secret. What if we were asked to proclaim Jesus as Lord and Savior? There are times when you wonder, is this the time that I should say something? Let me just suggest to you that if not then, when? Go ahead. Do it. You might not be ready, you think. You might not think that you have the answers to address a situation with people. But if you look closely at the example of the apostles, and especially Paul and others, as they are charged with these questions from people who are opposed to them, they don't talk about, well, scriptures and Jesus Christ and sacrifice as much as you see them telling them, what is your story? What changed? What about it changed your life? What about it can change their lives? That's a story that you're familiar with. You don't have to study for that. You don't have to prep for that. And if you need more than that, the Holy Spirit will provide it. But let's not slam the door on the Spirit and say, no, I'm not ready. I don't have anything to say. We each have our own stories, and it's important to share them. On the job, at school, or are we just going to be secret disciples? John 19, again, verses 41 to 42, says, now in the place where they crucified, he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had been laid. And so there they laid Jesus, because the Jews' preparation day, and the tomb was nearby. Matthew 25:27 adds a little more. Matthew 27:57 through 60. Now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. And this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And Pilate commanded that the body be given to him. And when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of rock, and rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb, and departed. Let's stop it for a moment and talk about a couple of things here. This is a new tomb, but not necessarily hewn, just newly hewn, but it was not yet used. And, well, one might say that here Jesus, the one born in a virgin womb, was buried in a virgin tomb. Born in a virgin womb and buried in a virgin tomb. And prophecy was fulfilled. Isaiah 53:9 was fulfilled. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had no violence nor was any deceit in his mouth. Now, I know looking out at this audience that most of you will remember a great radio talent and man, Paul Harvey, who died just a few years ago. Miss that guy. Miss that noon, 15 minutes of noon news and commentary. But he used to say, now I'm going to tell you a little bit more than I know for sure. I'm going to read between the lines and connect the dots a little bit and bring this backstory to a conclusion that I think will surprise you and amaze you and hopefully encourage you as well. How rich was Joseph? Scriptures don't tell us. But he was well off enough that he was a part of the Sanhedrin and among the Sadducees, who were the wealthier portions of the people in that area. When did he purchase the tomb? Scriptures don't say. But let me ask you, why would a rich man purchase a tomb so close to Golgotha? A scene of crucifixion after crucifixion after crucifixion. And why would he plan to be buried there in such a likely low-class burial area? I mean, you go to the burial grounds, the cemeteries, and you go out, and if you're looking for a rich man, where do you go looking for his tombstone? It's not down in a swampy area where it floods and where the water stands, not where there's a little headstone about the size of that Kleenex box. No, there are gardens and there are flowers and there are mausoleums and there are big things, big to-dos, if you will. Not something where there's a crook on this side, buried on this side of him, and you know, a murderer over here, and this, that, and the other. So, why would a rich man and a member of the Sanhedrin be buried with? Why wouldn't he be buried in a more noble and well-placed tomb? That's the question that first got me on this topic. And I said, that doesn't make sense to me. I can't believe that it'd be that different back then. So I'll share with you here a possible scenario. Perhaps Joseph, and maybe even Nicodemus, since he was a teacher of the law as well and had some personal experience and interchange with Jesus. What if they believed Jesus? That he was going to be dead for only 3 days and three nights. He was only going to need a tomb for a short time. He didn't need to buy it. He just borrowed it for 3 days. They came forward. They were the ones, while the apostles and the other disciples were in the upper room, quaking in their sandals, wondering, what are we going to do? What's next? Expecting soldiers to bust through the doors at any time to come and get them. They didn't go in bed for the body. They didn't prepare ahead. Joseph and Nicodemus did. They believed the scriptures. They knew the scriptures. They were teachers of the scriptures. And they foretold that the scriptures foretold of Messiah's first coming as a sacrificial lamb. And unlike the other disciples, they actually believed that Jesus, when he talked about his death, at the very Passover that had just taken place. Recall what Jesus had told the religious leaders in John 5, verse 39. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me. They had scriptures, and both of these men had access to them. And they also had access to Jesus personally to attend some of his meetings and listen to his message. And after his resurrection, he said to two of his disciples on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24, Luke 24, verses 23 through 27. And he said to them, O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, ought not the Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them in all the scriptures the things concerning him, himself. The knowledge of these things was available in the Hebrew scriptures to those who had eyes to see and ears to hear. If this was the case, Joseph, in faith, may have recently purchased the garden tomb, not for himself, but because it was close to Golgotha, and he knew it would only be needed for a very short time. It was not a tomb worthy of royalty. Yet a humble king lay there for 72 hours. It was simply a borrowed and barely used tomb. And isn't it interesting and ironic that Jesus' burial was arranged and carried out not by Peter or John or any of the other disciples who the night before had beat their chests at dinner and argued about who loved him the most, but by two formerly secret followers, a Sadducee and a Pharisee, Joseph and Nicodemus, and accommodated by an unrepentant Gentile, Pilate. Three areas that one would not expect anything good to come for Jesus, and yet came together that way. Puts a different perspective on it, doesn't it? Not all of those Pharisees and Sadducees that we give what for to on every Sabbath deserved that it would appear. Back to our story. There were Roman guards at the tomb and placed there, of course, because the Jews were afraid that Jesus would escape, and the Romans were as well, that something would happen and when there would be an uprising. On Thursday, the first high holy day, the first day of unleavened bread, Pilate placed guards at the tomb. And I'm reading now in Matthew 27, verses 60 through 66. Matthew 27, 60 to begin. On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember that while he was alive, how that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will arise. They knew it. They knew what Jesus had told them. They knew what he had preached, what he had said. 3 days and three nights. The sign of Jonah is the only sign that you'll have that I'm the Son of God. And, sir, therefore command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, he has risen from the dead. So the last deception will be worse than the first. And Pilate said to them, you have a guard, go your way. Make it as secure as you know how. And so they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone, setting the guard. Sealing the stone was likely done by a means of connecting a rope to each end of the round wheel of stone that rolled down in front of the door of the sepulcher and then sealed with wax so that it would be apparent if anybody had come and messed with the door or the stone, rolled it back or anything like that, and there was any, if there was any kind of tampering at all, it would be easily detected. And then, of course, when Mary came in Matthew 28, verses 1 through 6. Now, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to draw, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. And, you know, the angel didn't have to come down to let Jesus out. It was to let the others in. His countenance was like lightning, and his clothing was white as snow. And the guards shook for fear and became like dead men. And the angel answered and said to the woman, "Don't be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. For he is not here. He is risen, as he said. Come, see the place where the Lord lay." And they looked into that empty tomb. Matthew 28:11. And now while they were going, behold, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priest at all the things that had happened. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave them a large sum of money to these soldiers. And why? So tell them his disciples came at night and stole him away while we slept. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will appease him and make you secure. And so they took the money and did as they were instructed. And the saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. The Roman guards accepted the bribe and lied to their superiors. It's interesting that two periods of 3 days and three nights are involved here as well, just as a point to point out as we go through, so as to not to miss it. There are three days and three nights that Jesus was dead, and 3 days and three nights that he was in the tomb. Both had different prophecies to be fulfilled because of that. But a difference of a few hours, perhaps, from the time that he died in the mid-afternoon on that Wednesday of that week, and till he was raised and came out of the tomb Saturday evening. Anyway, the importance of the empty tomb is something that we should never, never take for granted or miss and forget, because 1 Corinthians 15, verse 26 says that the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Death. 1 Corinthians 15:54-57. So when this corruptible has put on incorruption, Paul writing to the Corinthians, and this mortal has put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, "Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, or grave, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." Satan had victory that day that Jesus died and was crucified. He had victory. And death and the grave appeared to have victory as well. They looked like the plan that Jesus and God the Father had put together had failed. But it was only a temporary victory. Temporary because 3 days later, death and the grave lost their victory through Jesus' resurrection. That resurrection from physical death to spirit life. That is what that empty grave should remind us of. The empty, borrowed, and barely used tomb represents the victory for us to be fulfilled or with God, to be filled with God's Spirit now and to have eternal life when Christ returns. I think most of you are aware I am, want to play a song for you, which actually, it was part of the stimulus for my message today as well. And we're not going to be able to put it out as a part of the copyright infringement issues and so forth, but we'll be able to play it here. And hopefully if you're listening at home or on a recorded version of this message later, you can go to YouTube to find and play the song. It's titled A Borrowed and Barely Used Tomb, sung by the Anchorman Gospel Quartet. And I'll just say that I made copies of the lyrics. Did we have those for distribution? Yeah. Let's have those passed out. You can read along with the words of the music as it's played. But you'll notice when the singing goes on, there is one word that is used in the beginning of the message of the song and the lyrics that is not normally a part of what we would look at, but considering the time of the year that all of this took place and the source of this particular song, the first Sunday morning is referred to one time as Easter. And we're not celebrating Easter, and we don't promote that among our congregations. But I hope that you won't let it impact or take away from the important conclusion that it offers to this message today. The message about the empty tomb of Jesus, sung about here in a way that, don't look at me unless you want to see a grown man cry. I love the song. It's powerful. It's moving. And I hope that it will be the right capstone for this message today. Thank you very much.